Hey, how's it going, everybody? This is Chris. Welcome to episode 29 of NML Crossing, where it's another late in the day recording because, well, I don't really have much of a voice in the morning right now. Still kind of coming out of whatever it was that I was in, and kind of have a bit of a hint as to what it might have been, because yesterday, Saturday, I had a hankering for oranges, and so I had some of those, you know, those easy peel, like cuties or whatever they are. I had some of those because I am a child, and took a bite and tasted nothing. So I'm starting to think that maybe I had that thing that, you know, we were all having and all continue to have. And if that's the case, at this point, the amount of times I've had it is equal to the amount of times I've been vaccinated for it. So, I don't know. I maybe there'll be a tiebreaker somewhere down the line. I guess we'll find out soon. Anyway, like I said, it's a late day recording here. It's I think the Super Bowl is in the second quarter right now, which is why I am recording a show. Those of you who know me will know that I prefer my sports to be predetermined. So not much of a football fan these days, but. Hey, if you are, I hope you're enjoying the game or enjoyed the game, and I hope your team won. So, with all that out of the way, how about we wrap up that raucous two-parter we started last time in Batman Shadow of the Bat number 79, which had an October 1998 cover date. The story is called The Blank Generation Part 2, A Favorable Wind, written by Alan Grant with pencils by Mark Buckingham, Bucky. Inks, Wayne Foucher. Colors, Pam Rambo and Android Images. Letters, Bill Oakley. Edits, Gorfinkel O'Neill. Cover price, $1.99. And before we get too much further here, apologies for whatever timbre my voice is currently at, because I got my earbuds in, but I can't hear how I sound. It's really, really frustrating, because I sound like I'm whispering, but I also sound like I'm screaming. So, hopefully it's neither of those, and it's somewhere comfortably in the middle, but we'll do the best we can. Now we open, and we pick up right where we left off last time. We got the Hatter and Narcosis, they're teaming up, and Hatter agrees to help Narcosis bliss up the entire city in exchange for one single favor. You see, he wants Narc's hat. Of course, it's of course he wants the hat, or his mask, shroud, whatever the hell it is. The thing of it is that Tetch wants it. Now, Narc is down with it, and he even offers to bliss, you know, the Hatter up right now. Jervis turns him down and says, save that for later. And now, as he says this, he's picking out a pair of hats for his flunkies to wear. Now, his flunkies, they're named Bert and Carno, by the way. Bert is the one who got blissed at the end of last issue. We shift scenes over to the high-security wing of the Gotham Hospital, where Batman's following up on his Narcosis hunch. Now, apparently last time they tussled, which I think, I was trying to do a little bit of research on this, there's very little written on Narcosis, unfortunately. And I don't have the issues that he appeared in, but I think he had an arc from Shadow 50 to 52 or so. And apparently it ended with Narcosis being sent off to this high security wing. It's like an underground area of the hospital. Now, as expected, Batman does not find the baddie there. Then he calls us into Oracle, and we also get a quick and dirty on Narcosis' origin. He had his face badly burned as a child, and hence the shroud that he wears. Now, Bats tells Babs about Narcosis' cocktail of choice, which is ketamine and that other word that I can't pronounce, acetylcholine? Acetylcholine? Anyway, she's off to search where he might have procured them this time around. Meanwhile, at Wayne Corp., our entrepreneurial pal James is explaining everything that went down during the board meeting he was, for whatever reason, asked to sit in on. Now, Wayne, of course, we know, is going to fund small businesses to lessen the sting of all the big corporations bailing out of Gotham. Now, this news, as stupendous as it is, doesn't really get the reaction he was hoping for. It's far more pessimistic than anything, which, I mean, you know, there's a thing about reading the room, right? You know, these displaced Gothamites don't know the first thing about starting or running a business. But they do eventually come around. I guess maybe that's too strong a word for it, or too strong a phrase. It's more like a, well, it's better than nothing, rather than a, oh boy, I can't wait to start a booming business, you know? It's, you know, whatever it is. In any event, James decides they ought to have a party to celebrate, and when asked, he does say that Bruce Wayne was a very nice man, but also kind of an airhead. Later on, Lucius Fox tries calling Bruce, but he ain't in, so Alfred takes a message. Now, this is a weird conversation. It turns out that, according to Lucius, they underestimated how many businesses they should try starting. I think, because these numbers are going to get ridiculous. It was going to be 10,000 Gothamites were going to be given their little nest egg, right? Now it's 100,000, which, I mean, like, I don't know how much of a nest egg Bruce is planning to be giving each would-be non-trained, non-experienced entrepreneur. But, I mean, 100,000 new businesses run by people who have never done anything like that? And, I mean, I know we've been saying this a lot lately, but money is a finite resource, right? Anyway, back with the baddies. Now, Bert's blissful nature is starting to even annoy Narcosis, even though he was the one who gassed him in the first place. They pass by a trio of blissed-out National Guardsmen on their way to a cache of butane and oxygen barrels. Now, Narc is planning on dispensing this chemical cocktail citywide via a nearby waste chimney. Bert and Carno start lugging the barrels toward the combustion chamber, and Carno, he complains about the silly hat that he's wearing. And Hatter's like, eh, just trust me. You know, keep the hat on, it's all good. From here, we pan out to see that the chemical cloud will head over to the quake shelter where James and the gang are currently living and partying at. So how about we check in on the party? It's the first time since the quake that many of these folks have smiled or felt in any way hopeful. Now, Lucius Fox shows up for the gala, but obviously, Bruce Wayne is not there. Back to Bruce, who is chatting up Oracle while driving his Bat Monster truck? I've never seen anything like this. Okay. Oracle directs him over to AZ Chemical Works, suggesting that it's his best bet for finding Narcosis. Speaking of whom, Narc and the Hatter chat for a bit about how they're going to work this plan. Now, the Hatter wants to be cagey and, I suppose, quake mastery about it. I suggest maybe dropping a small dose of bliss and then hold the city for ransom. You know, it's like, hey, you pay us this much or you're getting all of it. Narcosis cares very little for money. He really just wants to bliss the world. And so, swerve, bro. Jervis commands his flunkies to attack the Shrouded Geek. Unfortunately, they are way, way, way outmatched. They do distract him, though, creating an opportunity for Tetch to whack Narcosis in the back of the head with his cane. He then unmasks him, and it's here we see that Narc is, in fact, a very crispy critter. He kind of looks like Spawn without the mask. Old Jervis decides he's going to do the plan his way. He's going to hit Gotham with a small dose of bliss, then shake the bankrupted city down under the threat of a bigger dose coming. Now, just as the chemical cloud starts to emanate out of the chimney, Batman arrives. And he uses his rocket-propelled whoozy-whats it's attached to the monster truck to blow up the chimney stack. There's still a little bit of cloud to deal with, though. Batman then drives toward the fleeing Hatter and company, and they're dragging Narcosis with them for good measure. Batman KOs Bert with just one punch. Then Narcosis wakes up and unleashes some bliss gas in Batman's direction. Batman, as it turns out, can dodge a cloud, so he's good. He then twists Narc's wrist cannons, making the doofus bliss himself. Then the Hatter puts Carno's stupid hat on Batman, and this hat evidently has some mind control hoodoo circuitry in it. And, like, you'd think this might be a big deal, but Batman basically just takes the hat off his head, right? It's like this dramatic scene of the Hatter jamming this stupid-looking hat on his head. And, like, the next panel, Batman takes it off. So, what are you gonna do? Meanwhile, Oracle is already in contact with, well, the helicopter company? Some place with a helicopter. In order to get a helicopter to disperse the bliss cloud. Tesh then starts firing willy-nilly in Batman's direction, and naturally he hits one of those barrels of butane, and so we get a big-ass explosion. We zip over to the quake shelter where a chopper appears, and then they spray fuel vapor into the bliss cloud, which ignites the thing, leaving us with an aurora borealis effect. I swear we're getting that a lot, aren't we? I mean, this has got to be like the third time we're seeing an aurora borealis over Gotham, and I want to say they've all been in shadow, too, haven't they? Anyway, this takes us to the end, where we learn that the big-ass explosion killed Narcosis, Bert, and Carno, and we close out with Batman Durher one-punching the Mad Hatter. And that is the end. Next time out, we are back in Anthology Land with Batman Chronicles number 14, and it's gonna be something. But now, before we talk about the issue here, we do have our letters page. And we've got Heather in Alabama, who starts us off here, says she really appreciates how the quake has affected Batman. She says that it's not often we see him as being or feeling helpless, small, or feeble. And that's especially true, this is me talking here, this is especially true around this time, as this is the, you know, span of time online where, you know, the term Bat-God was being thrown around a lot. Mostly due to how Batman was depicted in JLA. But it is strange to see him, you know, at a disadvantage, like he has been since Cataclysm. And I like that the readers of the day can appreciate that as well. I think that's pretty cool. Next up, we got Mac in Indiana, who hates crossovers, hates them a lot. Says that they force Batman to play nice with the rest of his cast, and he doesn't like that. He says that the big crossover stories are barely even mentioned after they're over, which makes them feel anything but major. And he cites Contagion and Legacy as being these huge stories that barely get a mention after the fact. And I mean, I can almost understand. I can understand that for sure. I definitely can get that because, especially in the current year, you know, where everything is constant crossovers. I mean, I don't think there's a week out of the year where there isn't a crossover going on, right? So we kind of get that now. Back in the day, it was a little bit different. You know, you'd get your one crossover a year. Maybe, you know, maybe you'd get a Bat crossover and then you get a wider DC crossover. It jumps back and forth. But honestly, how much from a crossover do you need to be refreshed on constantly? It's like, do we need, like, a scene every issue of Batman having breakfast with Alfred and being like, man, I'm glad the apocalypse plague's over. We don't need that every time, but his point is still well taken. Now, not only does Mac hate crossovers, he also hates Vesper Fairchild, apparently. Now, Vesper, I don't know Vesper very much. All I know is how she left the books. I was not reading when she came in, and I don't know the temperature of the fandom when she came in. I don't know if people dug her, if they hated her, if they thought she was forced down their throats, or whatever we comic fans say about new characters, right? But Mac hates her. He says he wishes a brick went through her head during the quake. Well, Mac, in a couple of years, one thin dime will do you. And if you know, you know. He also hates Alfred. This dude, why is he reading this book? He wishes the giant penny crushed him during the quake. He is also skeptical that this story will result in any actual long-lasting change for the status quo. Whether it does or doesn't, he hates everything. So what's... Mac, find a new hobby, pal. Next up, Nick in the UK, who just writes in to say Cataclysm is good. And I'm assuming he means the story Cataclysm and not like the concept of Cataclysm and human existence and stuff like that. Next up, Jorge in Mexico. He compares Cataclysm to the 1985 Mexico City quake. And he says he was there and he has friends who lost loved ones in it. And he says that there are still ruined buildings there even 13 years later, which tells him that the time it takes to rebuild Gotham might, it may never turn back to what it was. Now, of course, we have a million years of hindsight to tell us what happened, and several continuity changes, but yeah, that's something that I dig being in, like, the forefront of the reader's mind here. Like, will Gotham ever be back to normal? Like, heroes have changed cities before, right? heroes have changed coasts. They've jumped around. Would Batman leave Gotham for a bit? Would Gotham not be a place? Would it be a totally different place? There were a lot of questions, and I really dig that. Next up, we got Dave in Minnesota, who says Shadow 75 was a masterpiece. He says Cataclysm has been one of the best Batman stories of all time, and he really enjoyed the backup story, saying that it showed how the regular people of Gotham were affected by the quake. And yeah, he's totally right there. You know, we met, was it, I think it was Walter, was the guy who worked in the deli, and his, like, he accidentally dropped his son, and then the quake happened and all that stuff. That was a pretty interesting story that, you know, the kind of story that I would expect from, like, Chronicles, maybe. You know, we'd see something like that. And I think Chronicles, the first issue of Chronicles that we read, did a pretty good job of that as well, showing what the, you know, non-Bat characters were having to deal with. We had people trapped, we had people missed by the recovery efforts. It was, you know, pretty good snapshot of the suffering that was going on in the wake of the quake. And the backup story in Shadow 75 was also quite good in that regard as well. Next up, we got Paul in California, who is a reserve member of the government's Office of Emergency Services, who assists FEMA. He says he spoke with people after the Northridge San Fernando quake, and he says how so many of them, even those who had just lost loved ones, were focused on carrying on and moving forward. And as such, he really enjoyed that Walt backup in Shadow 75. And I tell you, that's a pretty illuminating perspective. And I wonder how Alan Grant received that missive there, you know, knowing that the story he told was so true to life from someone who lived it, breathed it, and deals with it. That's pretty cool. Now, our final letter is from John in St. Louis, who is enjoying Cataclysm and says that Shadow especially has kept him on the edge of his seat. He says that Cataclysm is a conscientious crossover, since he didn't need to buy books he didn't normally follow in order to keep up. And as such, he decided to skip Chronicles and Catwoman like he usually would. And he thanks the Bat Office for doing it this way and not treating the line like a cash cow, which makes me wonder if John is still reading comics today, and if so, what he thinks about the cash cow that the Bat books currently are and have been for quite a while. So those were our letters. How about we talk about the issue we just read here? That supervillain team-up didn't go so well, did it? You almost feel bad for Earl Narcosis. He comes across as being, like, way too trusting, like, naive, in a way. And again, like I said earlier, I'm not totally sure what his story is outside of being burned as a child. But this issue we just finished now is actually the last time we will ever see him. The death stuck. He's gone. He's donezo. I don't even think he was Black Lanterned. He's done deal. Makes me wonder if maybe he was a loose end that Alan Grant really wanted to tie up before leaving the book himself. We've only got one more Alan Grant arc on Shadow before it enters, like, the No Man's Land Round Robin, which is going to be pretty weird. I wonder if he knew that at this time, that, you know, things were going to change and the creative teams are just going to go nuts as we get into No Man's Land proper. Now, speaking of weird, after this issue, fans of the day would have to wait 2 months for their next true installment, because the next issue to be released would be the DC 1 million one. So you get a weirdo, far-flung future story, and then you come back to No Man's Land. And I kind of feel like I'm already vamping for time because, you know, I think I expected to have a lot more to say about this issue. I gave it a bit of credit for being an uncharacteristic two-parter in Aftershock, right? But after reading it, it kind of just feels like they stretched out a single issue into two because they were butting up against the 1 million thing. I mean, it wasn't bad. It was actually quite good. I enjoyed it a lot. And thing of it is, it did not feel decompressed or padded. It just felt extended. You know, back then, comic pros could actually write that way, where they could stretch a story without it being, you know, 45 pages of talking heads around the, you know, the Avengers breakfast table, you know. But thing is, there just ain't a whole lot, heck of a lot to say about it that I didn't already say last episode. The big takeaway from this two-parter is still the fact that Gotham's non-Wayne corporations are leaving, and the power, slight as it might be, is being given to the ordinary people in order to innovate and financially resurrect the city. I guess I could say it was nice seeing a bit of optimism from the rank and file Gothamites. Now, of course, we know what they're actually going to be in for as we work our way through these next several chapters. But for now, I suppose it was nice to see some smiles. And it makes me wonder, what did the readers of the day think? Like, did they think maybe somewhere down the line they'd get like a 6 months later style jump ahead where like James and the rest of the Gotham Amateur Entrepreneur Club have started tremendously successful businesses and along with the Wayne fortune completely rebuilt the city? Maybe? Don't know. Like we've been saying from the jump, you know, this is a pretty gutsy story to tell. And I just wish I could find some actual constructive conversation about it from back in the long ago. Most, if not all, of the reactions that I see are of the knee-jerk variety. Or, as mentioned previously, trying to pick it apart for its lack of internal logic. I mean, there are some boosters on the old Usenet with like a wait-and-see point of view, but little in the way of actual speculation. I guess even back then, it seems, we comic fans were terrified of being proven wrong. Now, if you were reading at the time, can you remember what you thought as the Aftershock era was winding down? Did we already know No Man's Land was on the horizon, or did we not know anything yet? If anyone out there can enlighten me, please do. But I don't have much more to say about it. I guess this was a fine wrap-up to this odd little two-parter. We got Narcosis off the table, and for the first time since the Quake, we have a little bit of optimism. So hopefully it'll all keep going in that direction. Well, we know where it's going. But I think that's about all I got to say about the issue. Now, before we cut out, how about we hop into the mailbag here at the Batman 557 edition, or at least talking about that episode. And we're going to start with our friend Chris Yu, who says, "It's always nice to see a forgotten character make an appearance. Ballistic was never my favorite New Blood character, but at least Mensch did make his backstory a part of this tale from anyone meeting him here for the first time. But I think it was a swing and a miss at trying to get new eyes on the character, or to get new people interested in a character that had a special place in Mensch's heart." And you know, yeah, it was a weird guest spot, to be sure. And I'm trying to think, like, who else could they have used there? I'm sure there could have been any number of people they could have used there, but, I mean, it was Mensch's character. It was Mensch's character, who had already been tied to Gotham City and knows the ins and outs of the GCPD, so it was a pretty good character to use. The thing of it was, you look at these Bloodlines characters, and outside of one, they really didn't do a heck of a lot with them. You know, that was like a weird time in comics. 1993, Marvel did that too in their annuals, where they introduced a new character in each of the annuals, and it's like where we got, like, I think the Executioner showed up in an X-Men book. We had, like, the Battling Bantam, like a Rooster-themed one in either Spider-Man or Captain America. Just these, like, silly characters because that was kind of the tone and tenor of the market back then. You know, everything was predicated on first appearances, you know? Or not everything, but so much was, you know? We had some big first appearances, Gambit, Cable, Deadpool, Doomsday, Bane. And then it was just like, here's the Battling Bantam. Here's Ballistic. Here are the Cyber Rats and Empyrene and Uncanny X-Men. You know, just weirdo characters just trying to, I guess, just throw everything at the wall and hope something sticks. And I guess, you know, the only one that did was Hitman. And a lot of that probably had to do with the fact that Garth Ennis probably had a plan for him. You know, besides just dropping him in the Demon Annual. It's like, oh, I could actually tell stories with this guy. I can flesh him out. I have a cast already in place. We can throw him in Gotham City, you know? So what we wound up with was a bunch of, like, Image Light characters just, like, a year after Image already did the thing. So it was very, you know, very late to the party and no plan, no heart, you know? And, I mean, that happens in comics. That happens in comics now. You know, look at your collector's apps and see which books are going up in value. Here's Spider-Boy. or Bane's daughter, or another girl dressed up like a clown. I mean, it's silliness, but and it's got just as much heart as the Bloodlines characters. Well, actually, you know, Bloodlines was probably done more in earnest than the characters we get now. But anyway, back to Chris's message here. He says, comics today are following the pro wrestling model. Everything monthly or weekly builds to the crossover or pay-per-view. It all just exists to sell the big event in both cases. And, you know, I'm so glad you said that, because both are such a big part of my, you know, idle time. And the fandoms are so similar. You know, the industries are similar and the fans are similar. Like right now in wrestling, that we're heading to WrestleMania, and there's like a bit of an uproar about who's getting what match. And rather than just let the performers take us on a ride, people are like sending death threats, and people are going nuts, and people are boycotting or threatening to boycott. And it's like, just enjoy the damn show. Or don't, you know? It's just, and comic fans are very similar in that regard as well. And, you know, it's almost like an Ouroboros, a snake that eats its tail, right? The industries, they do these stunts, they do these things that build to like one big blow off, and then it goes away. And they sometimes give the fans the illusion that they're in control somehow. And it just leads to, you know, I hate the word toxic, but it leads to a toxicity, sort of a buildup that eventually bubbles over. And it's unfortunate. And it also kind of trains us into thinking that stories that happen in non-event issues don't matter. You know, it's just like that with wrestling, too. It's like the weekly show really doesn't matter. You don't need to watch the weekly show. I haven't watched the weekly show in years. I'll still watch the pay-per-views, and it takes me 2 seconds to get caught up. You know, it doesn't take much. But it's kind of like that with the with regular issues versus event issues. We're trained to think that if it doesn't have a big banner on top and an inflated price, that it's not even worth reading. It's not even worth looking at. It's not even worth buying unless Spider-Boy shows up in it. It's really too bad. But your point is well taken. It's the two industries are ridiculously similar, even to how much disdain professionals seem to have for the customers. Anyway, thank you so much for the message, Chris. We're going to hop into our next one here from our friend CJ. And he's got a few points he wanted to bring up here. The first one is, and this is in response to a dip into Usenet here where people were complaining about the, you know, how realistic the stories are. And just in general, how realistic comics are. And CJ says, how much explanation we need for comics? How much it needs to have a realistic explanation? I thought it was just an interesting and true point that the pendulum swings from Silver Age, just accept it, to sometimes more modern attempts at making it all logical. I myself have gone through those pendulum swings, preferring the more logical attempts in my late teens and early 20s, while mainly just taking the accepted approach as a kid and now. And I think we all go through that time, you know? And, you know, I always say that my time as a comics fan is the perfect time to be a comics fan, because comics kind of, and I bet everybody feels this way, but I'm right about it, because as I was, you know, entering my teen years, Vertigo became a thing, you know, Sandman became a thing, and it felt like the industry was growing up with me, or I was growing up with it. And so, you know, you'd want logic, you would want, even if it's magic logic, you want it to make sense, you want it to seem mature, you know, you don't want to seem like you're reading just a superhero story, you know, you wanted it to be more than that. And I think that, I think a lot of us go through that, and, you know, because then going into my 20s here, that's when the Bendicization of comics occurred. So it just feels like it's growing with me, where now I'm kind of burnt out on that. You know, I'm just like you mentioned here, it's that just accepted approach that makes it fun. You know, it makes it what it's supposed to be. You know, I don't need darkened rooms full of monitors where, you know, people in suits are talking about what the superheroes need to be doing. I don't need that. You know, I was never a fan of the, you know, 1966 Batman show, but screw it. Give me a bat pole. You know, I give me something silly. Give me something I can just accept, and almost, you know, can, like, force me to not ask questions. You know, CJ continues. He says, "I agree that trying to make things more logical is partly a response to wanting to show that superhero comics are for grown-ups, but I don't necessarily think that's the best or only way to do that. Making stories that have strong character development, thematic studies, and engaging plots, to name a few things, should be enough to do that. I think if those things are strong enough, we're more likely to just accept things and have fun with it. Trying to make superheroes make sense in the real world largely seems like a fool's gambit to me, and it also makes things far less fun." And, you know, actually, do I start, like, every, like, rejoinder with, you know? I that might just be some New York in me, I don't know, but, you know, I feel like a lot of recent current writers have made their careers off that question, you know, what would superheroes be like in real life? And the answer is generally the same. You know, superheroes would be horrible, and the stories about them would be very dreary and repetitive, because you can only do the same thing so many damn times, right? CJ continues. "I'm not saying there shouldn't be some attempt to have some internal logic and answer some questions, since Silver Age silly stories can quickly wear out their welcome. But sometimes raising and trying to answer questions of how this would actually work takes a reader out of it, because I don't think the answers are ever really going to make complete sense. Or, in order to make them make complete sense, something more valuable, like character, fun, or proper pacing, would have to be sacrificed." And that's totally true. That's totally true here. The one example I always go back to when trying to discuss wonky internal logic, because this is actually brilliant. It's silly, but it's brilliant. When Roy Thomas was doing his Golden Age revival stuff in the early 80s, they introduced something called the Spear of Destiny. And it might have been introduced before that, for all I know. But the Spear of Destiny was this thing that made it so if any of the superheroes tried to, like, interfere with World War II, they would have their mind immediately taken over. And I mean, it's silly and it's magic, but it explains why World War II happened, right? It explains why they didn't just go in and end it. Which, that's enough for me. You know, it's like, well, why didn't they stop this? Well, they couldn't because of this. Okay, that's cool. You know, they actually thought about it and they gave us something silly, but internal logic is kind of there. You know, you don't have to ask those questions. And I don't know if that's something that modern readers would glom onto necessarily. Because, I mean, the world is the world, right? We talk about, you know, the JLA not coming into Gotham City. Why don't they do it? Maybe we'll get an answer. Maybe we won't. But, I mean, even today, you know, there are wars, there's famine, there's all sorts of real world stuff that's going on. And we could lean on the Superman can't be everywhere at once sort of thing, or we could come up with some sort of gimmicky, magicky sort of explainer, you know? I'm not saying either one is better or worse, but I kind of dig that, like, they were answering the question just as we were asking it, in at least in the Spear of Destiny case. But who knows? I'm kind of just talking right now. Back to CJ. "An example of the balanced and more general approach I might like," we're going to return to Dwayne Fortune, "and say, overall, I don't like hearing that he might not have enough money to do the restoration and the charities he wants to do. Although I do think it will have bearing with the DC trip and the No Man's Land becoming a thing. Instead of what we've been getting, I think it would be enough in the DC trip to say he's going there because one company can't shoulder the burden of rebuilding all of Gotham City. That's close to what we have now, but focusing on it will only bring up more questions than it answers. I think just making the point once would get the story where it needed to go without needing to raise too many questions about the Wayne fortune. And a fortune, I might add, that should be explained as just being a huge conglomerate that makes and sells many, many things so that we have a justification for all his money without creating too many specifics and restrictions." And I think you put it perfectly there. I think not dwelling on it is the key here. But I mean, this is a personal problem for sure, because I dwell on these things way too much. I spend way too much time with single issues than sane people do. Add to that this story has the sort of kind of unique distinction of being one of the first major stories to come out in, like, the post AOL era, you know, where we had an online to go to, and we were able to discuss the minutiae and point things out and try to look like the smartest person there and ask these questions that would usually just be like a 5-second conversation in the comic store that you and your pal would talk about. But I don't know, when you give them like a physical form in like text form, you know, they're just always, I mean, they're still there now. These conversations, these arguments, debates, they're still there now. And until the end of this month, I could still reply to them. I mean, those people ain't there anymore, but I mean, technically I could still join in on these conversations in a way. I think that has a lot to do with the way in which this story was received online anyway. The folks out there who just wanted to have fun with their comics didn't have to worry about this stuff like we did, we Usenetters did. But your point is very well taken here. And, you know, the Wayne Fortune here just being a conglomeration of stuff, that's probably for the best. You know, you don't want to get tied down. You don't want to get into specifics because anytime you do, you run the risk of being contradicted or contradicting yourself. I remember thinking it was the coolest thing in the world at the end of Zero Hour. There was that fold out with like an actual timeline for the DC universe there. Everything was right there. You know, you knew when anything, everything happened, how it went down. And I remember hearing some of the, I hate saying older people because they're probably half my age now, but older people at the comic shop who were around for Crisis and stuff, and they thought it was terrible that DC would put this timeline at the end of the book because they'd been through Crisis, and Crisis was being contradicted weeks after it ended. And here with Zero Hour, you had like this definite time frame. You had everything on a scale. And it's like, wow, how soon are they going to mess that up? And since this is comics, it didn't take long for there to be contradictions. So generalizations are definitely key. Back to CJ. In regards to killers being on elite groups, he says, I generally don't like this, but since my first deep dive to the JLA came with Morrison's run, I have a soft spot for Huntress being on the team. I don't think it made much sense with the Bat Family characterization of her and her relationship with Batman, but she seemed more toned down in JLA. I can't recall her wanting to kill people there. I think it worked somewhat. Reducing Helena's bloodthirsty nature in JLA stories made it work somewhat, but only because I would think Helena would be less aggressive when she had to justify a more violent approach to beings more powerful than Batman. Also, while it's been a few years since I read that run, I know Morrison did give an explanation later as to why Batman recommended it, although I think their explanation was still a little lacking. And, you know, I've been reading a lot of thoughts of the day on Huntress joining the JLA, and someone on Usenet cited an article from Wizard, an interview with Morrison that I didn't even think to dig up and try to confirm, but I probably could, that the JLA that Morrison was putting together was supposed to be analogous to the pantheon of Greek gods, where Huntress was going to be the stand-in for Artemis, the, you know, goddess of the hunt. And I guess Ollie was dead, and Connor had already come and gone with a stint on the JLA, so they went with Huntress. I feel like that's kind of a weak excuse to fit her on there, but I think Morrison was really pushing for, you know, the pantheon type vibe with JLA, even from, you know, the get-go with his with that volume. Now, as for toning Huntress down, I think your point is well taken here that you know, I can't see her telling Superman, I need to kill this person. But, counterpoint, with Superman and Wonder Woman on the team, she wouldn't have to kill anybody, probably. You know, they'd be able to take care of all the heavy lifting, so to speak. Now back to CJ. Regarding Deadpool being in elite groups like the Avengers, it doesn't make much sense to me, other than for money-making reasons, sure. But I'm also not a huge Deadpool fan. Well, that's the thing. I do enjoy Deadpool. Anybody who listened to X-Lapsed, whenever we had a Deadpool appearance, when we started getting Deadpool appearances, I dreaded them. I was like, oh crap, I don't want to read about this guy. I hate this guy. And they won me over, like every single time. It was so much fun having Deadpool in the books. And as X-Lapsed was winding down, he was, you know, joining X-Force, like, officially, and it's like, oh, he's gonna be here every month, and then he got his own volume in the, you know, Reign of X, or whatever the hell it was back then, and I was so psyched, but then, you know, the wheels kind of fell off that, but yeah, I'm a fan of Deadpool, but him on a team like the Avengers just does not make sense. I know back in the day, Joe Kelly's Deadpool, which was fantastic, he would he had this running plot that Captain America was his hero, which was a lot of fun. So I could see Deadpool wanting to be an Avenger, but it actually becoming a thing? Outside of the money reasons, I just don't see it as well. One more from CJ. He says, regarding 0 and 1 million issue filing, he says, I do view the 0 and 1 million issues as part of the series, but I've gone back and forth on whether I have them in numeric order or during the month it was released. Part of me likes having it in numeric order because it seems to be the easiest and cleanest approach, but I also like the idea of having it in the context of when it was released, of seeing what else was going on right before and after it. Now, I totally get that. I get, like, wanting to have them, you know, in the gestalt of the, you know, where it came out. Thing of it is, for me, is I would never be able to find the thing again. You know, it's like knowing that Shadow of the Bat 1 million comes between 79 and 80. How would I know? I would never, ever know. Like, if I wanted to grab that issue for a particular reason, I would never find it. It would take me forever. And I mean, I'm so anal with my filing, as I've discussed here, long form, extra long form. Like, I have a short box right now with all of the NML Crossing stuff in it, in order of how we're going to be covering it. And it kills me that the books are not where they belong. You know, they're in a temporary home. So, like my Detective Comics run has a big gap in it right now. My Batman run has a big gap in it right now. It makes me itch. It's ridiculous. But just knowing that I have them in a temporary home is... It skeeps me out. It really, really does. When I started collecting comics in, you know, earnestly in, like, in 92, I remember collecting the Executioner song, the X-Men crossover, and I went back and forth on how I was supposed to find... I didn't even have a box yet. You know, I didn't have a short box, a long box, I had nothing. I had a shelf where I just stacked everything. And I remember thinking it was so cool when I had, like, 5 of one series, and I had, like, and that was, like, my little stack of X-Men Volume 2, you know? Humble beginnings. But I remember, like, having a stack for just the Executioner song books, and, like, having them in order of, you know, chapter. But then, like, freaking out because, like, oh, that belongs in X-Men, that belongs in X-Force, and I went back and forth on it so many damn times. So this has been with me, Jesus, for 32 years. Oh, God, what happened to my life? Oh, boy. With that said, though, I appreciate that you have the same worries that I do and you go back and forth as well. Makes me feel a little less insane, or at least in very good company. So thank you so much for sharing in my silliness, CJ. I really, really appreciate it. We got one more message here from my buddy Dave, came by a text, and he says, for the record, when I stayed on top of my sorting, 0 always goes before 1, regardless of release date. Before number 0 or number 1 go flashbacks, one-shots, specials, and annuals. And, you know, that's something that I've seen at shops. Sometimes they'll put the annuals in the front, like before the ongoings. Sometimes I'll put them in the back. We've got one chain of shops out here that does it the first way, where the annuals go, like if it's Batman, the first clump are going to be the annuals, and then it'll be, you know, volume one, number whatever. And that always feels so wrong to me. I mean, I'm trying to think of, because I even just recently made a change to my Nightwing long box, because I was doing everything in order of release, which is uncharacteristic for me, because the first Nightwing book wasn't Nightwing number one, you know, the ongoing, it wasn't Nightwing number one, the miniseries, it was Nightwing Alfred's Return, the one shot, and I put that in the front, because that came first. But then I'd look at it, and it's like, no, that has to go at the end. I can't, it's silly, it's ridiculous, I'm sick, but, I had to put it at the end. I've changed it like 3 or 4 times since November. It's sad, but I am what I am, and I'm sure I'll change it again. I'm sure I'll change again. It's funny, thinking about the various ways that shops file things made me think of something else. Think of another burning question to ask and share here regarding how you bag and board. Because I've got a lot of shops here that, do the standard, what I consider the standard. You know, it's like the book goes in, you know, the flap is on top, folded over the backboard with a piece of tape, right? We also have a shop out here that does it the way I consider upside down. The flap is at the bottom of the book, folded under and taped. And that always, it's kind of weird to me. It's kind of weird. But I don't know if that's like a way people actually store their books. Like, do you put them right side up or upside down? Do you tape? Do you tuck? Do you tuck? Because the way, when I started collecting comics and I got my first bags and boards and thought I was the coolest kid in the room, because I was the only kid in the room, I would tuck them behind the backing board. You know, the flap would go over the book, over the board, and then tuck in. I didn't tape anything because, you know, I reread these things so many damn times. So it would be ridiculous. I'd be going through a lot of tape or I'd be risking tearing stuff up. Later on, I found a shop that didn't use tape at all. They would just tuck the flap in between the book and the backboard. And I've kind of adopted that way for myself. That's how all my books are. You know, except for the handful of self-sealers I got. I don't like self-sealers too much because they're sticky. And it's like I like having the ability to take the books out without risking wrecking it. But I want to know what you guys do. How do you guys store your books here? Do you tape? Do you tuck? Right side up? Upside down? Do you use self-sealers? Do you swear by self-sealers? I really want to know, because I think I've just crossed the finish line and have become the most boring man on the planet. But anybody listening, please let me know how you store your books. So silly. Oh, boy. And if you'd like to do that or reach out about anything, please feel free to do so. You can find me all those different ways. Chris is on InfiniteEarths.com, WeirdComicsHistory@gmail.com, all the social media places. That'll be, I think they're linked in the show notes. I don't remember. Hopefully they are. There's also the YouTube channel here that's also should be linked in the thing. I think we got a couple of subscribers there, which is weird. Well, maybe not so much weird, but definitely unexpected. So if you are among them, thank you and welcome. But I think here is where I will finally shut up. Welcome to the working week, everybody. Hopefully this will be a full week for me. And before I let you go, I just want to thank you all so much for spending some of your day with me today. And until next time, as always, I'll talk to you again real soon. See ya. Starting over when the story's got an astounding twist. You've